Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is a Lip Media podcast.
You're listening to Queers, a podcast about politics and culture with Simon Copland and Benjamin Riley.
I feel like we should get rid of the music and just
have me singing
have
that.
You doing that. Yeah.
Well, you give us a version as well. Great. Lovely. We could do like a harmonized one. We sing it at slightly different pitches and I'll mash them together. Perfect.
It's the 7th of June, 2019. I'm Simon Copland.
And I'm Benjamin Riley.
Welcome to Queers. Each episode, we talk our way through questions on a theme, and this week we're talking about sexual anxieties. But just before we do that, we should just note that I'm not exactly sure what date we'll be releasing this, but it will be well after the 7th of June. We are recording this episode. This is a two-parter episode, so we're recording both of these in 2 days. We've recorded both our last episodes a couple of weeks ago and these episodes in both times we've recorded two at the same time. That's because I'm about to go away on a 5-week trip to Europe, and we're not going to be able to be doing any recordings at that point of time, but we wanted to keep our episodes going, make sure we didn't have a big break. So we're just doing a couple in some batches, and so this episode will actually come out well after the 7th of June, probably into July, actually. The content we're talking about today will not be sort of time sensitive. You know, we hope you still enjoy it, and, you know, we'll be talking about, so, you know, what we often do in this podcast, talking about things that are sort of timeless in a way. So, I'm really looking forward to the trip, and I hope you all enjoy this episode.
I don't think we need to mount quite such a firm defense of what we're doing. I think it's, you know, it's good that we're organized. It's good that we've got our shit together enough to bank up some episodes.
You and I both went on trips, we had like a big break of like 6 or 7 weeks with no episodes. So I feel like it's nice to be on top of things.
Yeah, it's not a common experience for me to feel like I'm on top of things at least. So speaking of time sensitive, one thing that I did want to talk about briefly, which will be old news by the time this comes out, but I thought it would be nice to give a shout out to it anyway, is that we've had some really great news just in the last couple of days before we've recorded this, which is that the plan by the Therapeutic Goods Administration in Australia, which is the body that basically approves or decides what medicines and other substances are treated in what ways in terms of legal classifications and that sort of things, had planned to change amyl poppers. So I think they're called different things in different places, amyl nitrate or poppers or the things that you sniff as a sex aid, basically, were going to be put into a higher class of drugs that would have made them illegal.
Effectively banned,
yeah. I mean, they're sort of in a – they up until now have sat in a murky legal area. It prompted a really fantastic grassroots campaign from within gay communities to challenge the decision that the TGA was planning on making and to have them regulated in a way that made a lot more sense. And the TGA announced this week that they are not going to be put into that higher level of classification and instead will be available through pharmacists as a sex aid, which is fantastic.
It sort of takes it out of that murky position where, you know, I mean, there'll be people who have no idea how to get them, where you can actually now go buy them at pharmacies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's still, so some, there are different classes of them and they're being treated in slightly different ways. So some of the ones that are considered to be more dangerous are being banned. But I'm not aware of anyone in who's a regular user of these that would have a preference for one kind of chemical makeup over another. So I think it's fine that some are being banned while others that all kind of serve the same function are actually being made easier to access in a safe way.
Yeah, it's great news.
You know, we can critique queer politics a lot and the way that pragmatic political action takes place around queer issues on this podcast quite often, but this is such a great example of a grassroots political response from within our communities that has led to a really fantastic outcome combating the criminalization of queer sex.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, for me, it's one of the big things about this is the focus on sex and the willingness of this campaign to embrace queer sex and not to shy away from it. You know, and I think, you know, for something like this, it's all about sex. Like, there's nothing, you can't not talk about sex when talking about something like this. And so it's really great to have seen a campaign that did engage in sex, that talked about queer sex, and that won. So I think these are all really positive things.
Totally. And actually does dovetail more than I realized with the stuff that we'll be talking about on the episode today.
Yeah, well, let's get to that then.
A couple of months ago, we got a fantastic email from a listener in response to our episode about queer sex. Well, our episode specifically about queer sex, that is, Filthy Queers. The listener posed an interesting question. In communities and political movements so often focused on sex, how do we include those who cannot do sex?
This question has got us both thinking quite a lot, and we've decided to dedicate two episodes to discussing the issue from a couple of different angles.
Today, we want to talk about sexual anxieties, how they can manifest within queer communities, and their relationship to queer politics. Hang-ups about sex are certainly not uncommon, but what do they mean for communities often so focused on sex?
Where do sexual anxieties come from? What is different about them within queer communities? And how can we deal with issues of sexual anxiety within community spaces that are so often focused around sex and sexuality? So Ben, let's get started. Obviously, sexual anxieties are a thing that everyone encounters to some extent. Do you think it is different for queer people?
I don't want to overstate the specificities of sexual anxieties for queers, because I think it's important to acknowledge and continue acknowledging that, like, everyone has anxieties about sex. They're kind of deeply embedded into our society as a whole and have been for a long time. I think that there are a few things that make some of these issues specific to queers. I think that the ways that queerness generally is othered and seen as shameful or abnormal, particularly in the experience of people first coming out and as kids and as teenagers, is obviously in sexual development going to have a huge impact on how those anxieties might manifest. So I think that that is an important distinction. And then I think specifically for gay men as well, the legacy of AIDS has a massive impact on how sexual anxieties manifest, and that fear of contracting HIV and the complexities around that are obviously going to play a role for lots of men in particular.
Yeah, actually, I hadn't even thought of the point of HIV/AIDS before we started this conversation. But it's so obvious in terms of a specific thing that sort of is so dominant within queer spaces and gay male spaces in particular, and something that is really drummed into gay men about that potential and the fear associated with that, I think, creates a lot of real anxieties. And I think there's been so much stuff about PrEP as being a thing that has sort of eased a bunch of sexual anxieties for people, for gay men in particular, as a way of sort of lifting a burden almost. And it's interesting, you know, I think that that's a slightly different topic from what we're talking about today, but I think there's some real interesting dynamics that exist around that. But maybe we could go into, you know, I think it might be worth, is it worth going into, we've touched on this a lot on the podcast, this sort of othering of queer people. And I think we speak about that in terms of a whole range of political issues and the sort of response that comes through respectability politics. And I'm intrigued about, maybe it's worth just delving in a little bit about how that influences the way we talk about sex in particular. You know, in this episode, we're talking about it in a way that thinks about this sort of almost at a micro level. You know, how does this influence individuals? How does this change the lives of people? How does it influence the sex lives of people? Because I think that you're right that we live in a society in which sex is different and almost considered shameful for everybody. But I think it's particularly true for queer people. And I actually think this would be even more so in many ways for example, lesbian women, where I think we talk about lesbian sex, you know, women on women sex a lot differently than we do gay male sex. I think those spaces are often less sexualized, or when they are sexualized, they're sexualized for men's interest, for straight men's interest.
Certainly from the perception of people not in those spaces. There are, like, because obviously in reality.
So I'm thinking about the outside forces that influence those spaces is what I'm trying to get.
Yeah, totally. Because, you know, we would certainly never claim that. Obviously, there are massive, like, kinky, sexy lesbian communities.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sorry, I'm thinking about how we perceive those spaces, and I think we often perceive gay male spaces to be much more sexualized from a outside stereotypical sort of perception. You know, when we think about gay male spaces, I think a lot of people think of, like, queer as folk, that sort of sexy. You know, you go for a club. You know, you go to clubs. You hook up with random dudes. It's Grindr. It's that kind of stuff. For lesbian spaces, I think it's often considered, you know, knitting circles, and you move in with each other after 1 week, and, you know, that sort of perception of lesbians as being about commitment and about, you know, nothing about sex at all is within that. And obviously that's not true, but I think that those perceptions, I think what I'm trying to get at is that these sorts of perceptions have a clear influence on people, like, that, you know, these stereotypes of these communities have influences on people, and they shape how we think about sex. And I think that that is something that, you know, it's really worth considering the influence that can have in queer spaces.
They're almost like opposite perceptions in some ways, in that gay male spaces are seen as really debauched, deviant sex pits, whereas for a long time, I think lesbian sex has been considered to not even exist. I mean, if you look at the legacy of British colonial rule in penal codes in Commonwealth countries, for example, it was often gay male sex that was specifically criminalized, because presumably people just didn't even think that two women could or would have sex.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, and you see that running throughout history. You know, the same thing happened in Nazi Germany. It was gay male sex that was criminalized in many places. And there was an assumption that either lesbian sex didn't exist, or that if it did, it was something that you could fix by just forcing a woman to be with a man. And it wasn't considered, you know, and that sort of awful stuff. But I think, you know, there's a whole bunch of history we could talk about in the way that these two approaches are spoken about. But I think it's interesting to think about how that manifests in our communities today. And, you know, and maybe it's worth thinking about whether we have any experiences of this. You know, it doesn't have to be our personal experiences, but, you know, we've spoken about in the episode on Filthy Queers, we spoke about the importance of sex within queer communities, but we sort of didn't really touch on the anxieties that people deal with, or the challenges that people deal with at an individual level, which I think we have to say are sort of influenced by all of these sorts of histories.
Totally. I also want to just go back and challenge something that you said earlier about HIV not being a part of this conversation specifically. Because I think it's just, like, super hard to separate, for gay men at least, or perhaps gay men of a certain age, anxieties around HIV from anxieties around sex generally. Like, if I think about my own early sexual experiences, there was definitely a lot of shame attached to, you know, the furtive gayness of it all. But I also left most of those sexual encounters convinced that I was HIV positive for, like, most of my 20s, I would say, or my early 20s at least, and late teens. Like, that played a massive, massive role in my relationship to my own sexuality. And the master's thesis, actually, that I'm writing at the moment is very much about the ways that anxieties about HIV have played into the development of respectability politics in gay communities. So I think it is super hard to disentangle those things, not just for, I mean, I think primarily for gay men, but that the legacy of the AIDS crisis in terms of its impact on how we think about sex or don't want to think about sex in queer communities more broadly is profound and continues to be felt in ways that perhaps we don't always recognise on the surface.
Yeah, I do agree with that. And I think back to my own experiences, and I think that I remember experiences of sort of lying awake or hearing about, you know, hearing information about HIV/AIDS, just coming across an ad about STIs or coming across some sort of historical, you know, some sort of story about it, and then spending ages just being convinced that I had contracted HIV, and or that, you know, this one experience has probably led to that, or freaking out because I hadn't been to see a doctor recently, and that, you know, that has passed for me. But you're right in that that is a thing that I remember very vividly as well. And I suspect you and I are not the only ones who have experienced that sort of feeling and those sorts of anxieties. And I think that it's, I'd be interested to know what that's like for, you know, for people who are turning 18 and 19 now. I have no idea. You know, it feels weird to be talking about young people because, you know, we're in our 30s now. So people who are coming into, into sexual maturity now, 17, 18, 19, learning these sorts of things. I really would be interested to know how that HIV message plays out, particularly in an age of things like PrEP and the sort of greater knowledge we have about these spaces, the greater options that we have for protecting yourself from not contracting HIV, I think is, it would be super interesting to see how that develops. But I mean, certainly for me, and as you've said for you, it really did play an important role.
I mean, this is literally what my research is about. So it's so I will hopefully be able to shed some light on some of these questions.
When you've finished written your thesis, we should have an episode about your thesis.
Oh God, if I ever get there, I'll be pushing for an entire year of episodes about my thesis.
Oh,
I'm sure.
Great. I'm looking forward to it.
Just to have made it worthwhile. Yeah, and I think it's kind of interesting to think about the nature of like generational turnover when it comes to things like shame about sex in queer communities as well, because we, as we've probably spoken about on the podcast before, one of the kind of weird things about queerness is that despite the fact that we have this history, because there aren't the same mechanisms as there are in a lot of other communities for transmitting historical information, in that it's not for the most part queer parents having queer babies and telling their queer kids about the history of the community. I mean, that's true sometimes, but for the most part it's not. How do people know about this stuff? And I think the answer is that often they don't. And so with every generation having to kind of rediscover this stuff on their own anew each time, it's interesting to think about how something like, I mean, the AIDS crisis being one example of something that happened within our lifetimes, but we don't have direct experience of, and how that might impact our experience of sex. But even things like, you know, we've made great strides in queerphobia, just a reduction in queerphobia over the past few decades. But what is it? So even if you're kind of coming out now and growing up in an environment where there may be less queerphobia than there has been in the past, I can't help but assume that there are going to be some remnants of the historical legacy of queerphobia that's existed for centuries, really, in some form or another, that trickle down and impact people's experience in some way, even if it is in that really kind of diffuse generational sense.
I have like two different ways I want to take that conversation. So I'm going to start with one and then come back to the other.
Great.
I think that that's so true, but I think that the reduction, you know, the strides we've made in queerphobia has also had, you know, and we've discussed this a lot on this podcast, the influence it's had on our discourse around sex, I think. And I, you know, in terms of the loss of sex within a lot of queer spaces, or the removal of sex within a lot of queer spaces, I wonder whether that has resulted in putting the shame onto ourselves almost, you know, in a space, you know, so, you know, in the sort of gay liberation times, it was like about embracing the sex part of queer spaces. And I think that, you know, we can look back on those space, those times, and think about them a little bit, you know, with sort of rose-coloured glasses, because I think that there are a lot more issues than, particularly around the discourse around sex, there have been a lot more issues than, you know, than we're willing, that we often see. But I think that at the same time, you know, when you have a respectability politics that decenters sex, it makes it... I think that has a potential to actually lead to an inverse where, you know, we have a reduction of queer phobia, but that queer phobia is about, that reduction is about love. It's about sort of marriage. It's about these sorts of respectable institutions. And it doesn't engage with the conversations about the stuff that happens behind closed doors. And I think that there's probably still a lot of shame that exists in that sort of space. But it's a shame that's now embraced in some ways by a form of respectable queer politics. And that really worries me. And I think that, you know, really strong examples of this, you know, and how this is can play out in real life is, you know, we're seeing the closure of, you know, sex on premises spaces. We're seeing the loss of a lot of these sorts of spaces within queer communities. You know, I have a couple of friends who are queer women who talk about how hard it is to get, like, you know, there's apparently been some sex parties starting up in Sydney for queer women, but, you know, it's very, very difficult for, you know, they sort of wish that they had the sort of access that gay men have to these spaces. But, you know, I worry about these spaces closing in gay male, you know, that, you know, saunas closing, sex on premise bars closing. I worry about these things and how it influences how we think about and talk about sex in queer spaces.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Yeah, I think that it's absolutely important to say that respectability politics has come about in large part by carving off the bits of ourselves that we deem unrespect we have gained acceptance by carving off the bits of ourselves that we deem unrespectable or bad, and sex is one of those. So it's not that queer sex has become more respectable, it's that we've kind of left it behind to embrace a more respectable version of ourselves. So that's absolutely true, I think.
And I think the other thing that I was really interested in talking about, and I'm feeling sort of a bit hesitant to talk about it, but I think it's, you know, we can sort of dip our toes in this question a little bit, is, I mean, one of the things that, you know, we see the sort of growing acceptance of growing changing perceptions around queer phobia and sort of discourses around sex. But I'm intrigued about how that plays out in an identity model around sex. And in particular, I'm really interested around the question of asexuality within queer communities and how discourses around that play out. I'm not here to question the notion of asexuality at all or the existence of asexuality. I think that that's definitely not something I'm intrigued to do, I want to do. But I think that I'm intrigued about how we deal with the nuances of this adoption of this sort of this identity that has sort of really become into form in recent years, alongside with the realities of the fears and anxieties that often come around sex, you know, and how do we, I think that sometimes we live in a world where often the things that we feel inside sort of are given an identity very quickly. And so rather than the sort of the potential that those things come from social conditions, they sort of seem to be essentialized. And I worry about the potentials of these sorts of fears and anxieties and hang-ups that exist around sex sort of being given an identity rather than sort of acknowledging as a sort of an essentialized identity. And I, you know, and I have no problem if people want to opt out of having sex. Of course, you know, I'm not going to be forcing anybody to have sex. But I'm intrigued about the essentialized nature of that identity and how that can play out when we have all of this history that exists around sexual oppression that can create these feelings in people. And how do we deal with this tension that can exist around that history? And do we have a responsibility to, as a community, to work through those histories to try and make people feel more comfortable about sex? Or is it really just up to anybody to decide, you know, okay, you know, this is who we are, and adopt the approaches that are best for you? Or, you know, of course we want people to adopt approaches that are best for you, but, you know, these are, you know, let's adopt identities that can sort of deal with the kind of current social circumstances we're in. Does that make sense?
It does. I am very hesitant to... I think we should be super careful about how we talk about this
in large part,
because we don't... We're obviously not asexual, and I don't know that much about asexuality, and I just... I don't want to make assumptions here that are simply not true. And I think the simplest response that I have here... And this is a bit of a cop-out in some ways, but I think that there's some value in kind of going, ultimately, who gives a shit? We should meet people where they're at and just, like, take people at face value and try to be welcoming and accepting of everyone and create spaces that are accepting of everyone. But I also acknowledge that given the... Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? I think we're going to dig more specifically in our follow-up in the kind of second part of this two-parter into the role of sex within queer politics. But, yeah.
Sorry, I know this is like, I guess I wanted to dip our toes in the water of this issue because I think it's an interesting one. And I agree, I don't feel like I know enough about it to really dive in deep here. And probably this might be a thing where we can try and find someone who knows better about this stuff to do an interview.
Oh my God, I 100% think that that's what we should do.
Yeah. But I think that there are some really interesting... I bring this up because it's a debate that I see happening a lot in a lot of queer spaces now. This huge debate around asexuality. And I think it can be super alienating for some people and can be super attempting to sort of close the doors, you know, to shut the doors behind us. But I think at the same time, I think that there are, I'm the kind of person who wants to, interrogate identity politics in different ways. And the sort of, it's interesting to think about these different identities and how they play out. And I think that asexuality is a super interesting one in the way that the discourse can run. And I'm not saying that, I really want to be very clear, I'm not saying that, you know, asexual people don't exist or that, you know, that it's, you know, that it's not a thing. And I 100% agree with you, you know, let people be who they want to be and do what they want to do. But I'm intrigued about how we deal with, I see the potentials of asexuality being a response to the sort of deep histories of sexual oppression and that exists within queer communities, and the deep anxieties that can come from that. I see some forms of asexuality or some as being a response to that, or some discourse around asexuality, not all of it, but some of it being a response to those things. And so I'm intrigued about how we deal with that as a community. And, you know, we had another question that said, that, you know, is sex positivity enough to overcome issues with sexual anxiety within our communities? You know, how do we deal with those sorts of sexual anxieties? I see that the potential of asexuality is being one way to deal with that, but are there, you know, I guess I'm questioning, is that always a healthy way or always the best way, or are there other things we should be doing whilst at the same time being, as you know, meeting people exactly where they are and being, you know, as open and inclusive as we can be?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that my kind of instinct here is, in the interests of critiquing our own positions, I suppose, which is something we always try to do at least, would be to flip that on its head almost and say, how can we more holistically perhaps critique the nature of sexual identity generally?
Like, yeah.
Like, I worry that there is a sort of assumption in, and I'm not saying this is what you're doing, but I think it certainly can happen in these sorts of conversations. There is an assumption in these sorts of discussions that by saying that certain experiences of sexuality are a product of anxieties or a product of shame in our communities is to imply that gayness, for example, is somehow a more natural position or a position that's not produced in those same ways.
Yeah, I think that is so true.
Totally. And I think it's really important to, because I feel like this was something that was really important to me in thinking about experiences of gender diversity. I think some years back I just had this like no shit moment where I was like, oh yeah, obviously, where I realized that I had been kind of essentializing cisgenderedness in my head in ways that I didn't realize. And I think just the kind of de-essentialization of all experiences of sex is a kind of interesting and important response to these sorts of questions, where we kind of go, okay, well, if anxieties about sex or hang-ups about sex are culturally produced, which I think, you know, fucking everything's culturally produced, so that is, I'm fine with that statement, then, you know, probably so are most experiences of sexuality and the ways that they manifest. So what can we think about this in different ways? Like the conclusion to come to from that is to go, well, back to that point of we meet people where they are and we just try to kind of accept everyone where they're at. Like, unless we want to reframe this and kind of go, are there, like, when is this a problem, basically? Like why should we care? Like, not why should we care, but like why does it even matter to interrogate sexual anxieties and sexual hang-ups? Like, who gives a shit?
Well, I guess.
I'm posing that as a kind of question for us to tackle, I guess. Who gives a shit?
I think that that's an interesting question to tackle, because I think that, yeah, I guess this is the nuances, this is the challenges I find. And I think you're right to step us back in talking about sort of the social construction of sexual identities in their entirety and how that can...
Well, just experiences of sex, not even necessarily sexual identities.
And I think that the reason I was interrogating this is because of the... And I think that, you know, why I think it's valuable to step it back, because I think this is true for all of our experiences of sexual identity in many ways, that there is a mixture of both value, sort of empowerment that can come from the way that we identify and the sort of labels that we can adopt. But I think there's also the potentials of harm and pain that can come from these things. And I think that it's interesting to interrogate both of those things together. And it's why I feel like, you know, meet people where they're at for me is... I think it's a great starting point, but I also sometimes don't think it's enough because I think that where we're all at, it comes from histories of oppression and histories of othering, and sometimes responses, and I think this is broad for everybody, and I'm going to step back from my sort of discussion of asexuality, and I was talking about asexuality in this context because of our discussions about sort of sexual anxieties, but I think we could say this for everybody, that there is an interest that I have that says that, well, if we acknowledge that there is harm that has come from some of these sexual identifiers, some of these sexual labels, and I mean gay and lesbian as part of this as well, like that there is this, that these labels have been created for particular reasons, and often they have been adopted as a way to deal with the current social circumstances we're in and to survive within those circumstances. And I totally appreciate that these labels exist because of the way we want to survive and the way we need to survive, and the embracing of these labels are about surviving within the space. But just accepting that sometimes means also potentially accepting the sort of crappy world we live in, and not thinking about like a broader potential transformative politics that sort of overcomes that and that works to overcome that, so that we don't need to be just surviving.
Totally. And look, ultimately, I completely agree with that. I think whilst I stand by what I said as a just way to fucking treat people on a day-to-day basis.
Oh, absolutely.
In terms of meeting them where they're at. I think that you go too far down that path, and that's where identity politics becomes this kind of extreme libertarianism that's just like, well, everyone should just kind of, you know, be quote-unquote who they are, and we should never push for anything different or you know, we should forget utopia, basically.
Yep.
And I suppose that raises the question of, like, what is the role of sex in a vision of queerness that we see as utopian, and is, and are sexual anxieties a problem for that and a challenge for that?
I feel like that's a really good segue into our second part, which
totally. I feel like that's a good that's almost a nice place to start for the second half of the discussion.
Excellent. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you'd like to support the podcast in any way, the best way you can do so is to become a patron on our Patreon. We have heaps of new content that is going up on the Patreon, and we have some new ideas for even more content coming soon. So if you'd like to sign up and become a subscriber, you can do so at patreon.com/queerspodcast. Otherwise, if you'd like to get in touch or make a comment, there are multiple ways you can do so via the internet.
Yeah, we're really trying to make it worthwhile for Patreon subscribers to be giving us money. So keep an eye out there. If you want to email us, you can do so at queerspodcast@gmail.com. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at queerspodcast. I'm on Twitter at Ben C. Riley. Simon is at Simon Copland, and he's also on Facebook at Simon Copland Writer.
You can find the podcast on our website, queerspodcast.com, or subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever it is that you find your podcasts. And please leave a review and rating when you do so. It really helps us in the rankings on these apps and ensures that other people can find us as well.
Also, tell a friend. We say this every episode because it really is the best way that people have to find us. If you know someone who you think would get into this and enjoy conversations about queerness that maybe don't always give you easy answers or answers at all, then let them know and get them to have a listen. And thank you, as always, to our podcast network, Lip Media. They're really fantastic, and working with them has really been a joy over the past couple of months. So thank you to the folk there.
Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we will see you in a couple of weeks' time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.